Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cock.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here!
Rock and roll, Joe.
And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at RantsRadio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays. And I don't know if you're going to notice that much of a difference. And I really didn't do it for quality of sound because at 64K bits, you're not going to get that much, even if it is in stereo. But I am recording this tonight using my new audio mixer. It is a Eurorack MX-802A. Audio mixer. This thing has 16 inputs, 4 regular mic inputs, which is what I really needed. And I realized that I don't really have anybody coming into the studio, at least not very often. But the problem is that on those times when I wanted to, I realized I only had the one microphone input. And with my old mixer, which was great, and I'm still going to make some use out of it in a different way, I really couldn't have – I had to just jury-rig something to get other microphones hooked up into it. This way here, I have a little bit more bass control because the only kind of bass control or treble control of any of that stuff, I only had it with my own mic. So anybody else sounded tinny compared to me, and I really, really don't want that. So when the time comes that I do have a guest or so in the studio, they will actually – be able to sound as good as I do. When I had Dave Merrill in here, I noticed he didn't sound as good as I did, and I don't like that. I like my guests to sound good on the audio. And again, I want to thank AB for the new computer because it rocks. It really, really rocks. It doesn't crash on me every 5 damn minutes. And once I get just a couple of pieces of software, like I mentioned last show, that I needed to get set up, then I will be 100% of what I was before. And I'm very, very happy for that because I really, really want to get, you know, back to where I was and even more because this is a faster machine. My wife sends me stuff occasionally and in email. Some of it's religious stuff, which I read and it is nice, but I'm not a particularly religious person. But this was something that she sent to me that was from mountainwings.com. Is that it, honey? Mountainwings.com. She's laying down. She's very tired. She's getting ready to go to sleep. She had a doctor's appointment today. So we're hoping that she gets the surgery that she needs next week or so. She needs a couple of surgeries of a nature too personal to reveal to my regular listeners. Suffice to say that it's something that she needs to have done. At any rate, she sent me something, and this is something I've talked about before, and something that kind of plays in because when she goes into the hospital, it would be very nice for me to go there and visit her and spend time with her during the day and not have to worry about going to work. But unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to do that. And a lot of it is because I don't have enough vacation time. Now, granted, I've only been working at the company for 10 months, and that's fine. But one of the other issues that working people deal with is a total lack of proper vacation. And people who work too hard tend to be a little bit more tense. If you don't get a little time off every now and then, depending on what job you do, you can go nuts. It's a very rare person that enjoys the job they do so much that a vacation is just unthinkable. There's not that many people that are really like that. There are people who will not take vacations for other reasons. They don't necessarily like the job, but they'll not take vacation because they want to get something back later on, some money back later on. I know in the military it was like that. People would not go on leave so they can save it up so that at the end of their tour of service they would get all of that money back in back pay, and that was pretty good. But we Americans don't have very much vacation time. For example, in my company, if you work for Siemens for about 25 or 30 years, you get a grand total of 23 vacation days a year. Now, that may sound good, but let me put this in a little bit of perspective. A private in the U.S. Army gets 30 days paid leave a year. Granted, generals get the same amount, but the point is that these people get a lot more than people who have worked in the service for that long. Worked at Siemens for that long. I mean, 25 years it takes to get 23 days. And this is true, and Siemens is one of the better companies for that. I mean, there are a lot of companies where you don't even get that much, and no matter how long you've worked there, you're not going to get that much vacation. You're just kind of expected to work till you die. And that seems to be the general attitude among workers. And the thing about it is some working people, they go along with that. Oh, sure, you're supposed to work. That's all life is work, you know. Well, according to this article from Mountain Wings, Get Some Rest, and I don't even know, let's see who wrote this. Christine L. Romero. And this is what she wrote. I'll read through it and I'll comment about it as we go along. So, the American productivity, vacation deprivation is running rampant, workplace experts say. American productivity is up, but so is depression and the amount of money spent on coping with burned out workers. And this is another thing I talk about, how this lack of vacation time is actually a detriment to the company. Never mind being a detriment to the people themselves, but for the company, it's also a detriment. And that's not good. That's not good for anybody. But according to Joe Robinson, who founded the Work to Live campaign, which is lobbying for a minimum of 3 weeks of vacation for all Americans, he said that right now it's a race to the bottom as companies cut labor to the bone. And basically a lot of what these big-shot CEOs are doing is cutting labor like crazy so that they can show that their company's making money. But, of course, the reality is they're not necessarily making more money. They're just cutting labor. That's saving money that way, but you're really not saving anything, and you're forcing everybody else to work harder. That's why you have situations where those who are working in some cases 50, 60 hours a week, and you don't have time to enjoy your life if you're constantly working. And according to Robinson, clocking more hours doesn't necessarily mean more work is getting done. He points to studies that show that workers deliver the same amount of productivity over 7 weeks, whether they worked 40 or 50 hours a week. And how many of you have had to do that? You work the extra 2 hours, but that last 2 hours, you're not really getting much of anything done. Even in the military, when I was in the service, and there were times that we had to work 12-hour shifts, you're not getting any more done. You know, especially those last 2 hours of a 12-hour shift, you're beat. You're just resting. And you know, you're too tired to properly focus on your job. And in my job in particular, I was in calibration. You got to have, you know, some focus, some concentration. And if you're tired, it's very difficult to calibrate a meter or to calibrate an oscilloscope or a spectrum analyzer. That requires some attention to detail. And you can't do that if you've been working 11 hours or so. At a plant like I'm working at, a manufacturing plant, If it's fairly physical, I mean, it's not like we lift heavy weights, but you're constantly moving, putting in screws, doing this, doing that, and it's kind of robotic, the same type of deal over and over and over again. And after a while, it's like, it's time to go. You know, I need to rest up. And if you're working 10, 12 hours a day, you're really not getting that much more productive. Speaking of being tired, you'll have to excuse me. It is 1:36 a.m. on Tuesday. I got home from work a couple hours ago, and I've had something to eat. So, and plus my sleeping pill for the evening, so I'm very tired. My wife is already settling in to go to bed. My wife is very pretty. And she's got her little dolly there. And she's still hurting, I know. My wife loves dolls. She's like a little kid with dolls. And the one she's got is one I got her, which has a little bandage on it. I mentioned this last show. Anyway, getting back to what I was talking about. According to the article again, Expedia.com's recent vacation survey suggests that Americans hand back to employees more than $21 billion in unused vacation hours. More people say they are taking less time away from work and feel guilt when they do break away. The e-leash, tethering workers to the office while they're supposed to be resting, is becoming increasingly common. That is where people still have contact with the work via email or something like that. Cell phones, email, remote access, voicemail make it easier to keep working even while you're on vacation. Cigna Healthcare, which by the way is my healthcare, doesn't have a set policy about workers checking in from vacation, said Lane Pittman, Executive Vice President of Human Resources in Phoenix. Most of our employees work directly with their managers to ensure their responsibilities are covered appropriately. There are times, given business needs, that it's not possible for workers to be out of touch with work. We may ask employees if we can contact them while on vacation. When there are companies, and Walmart is especially big on this, when they tell you that if you take a 15-minute break without clocking out, then you're stealing from the company. Well, basically, if you go on vacation time and your company asks you to do some work, they're stealing from you. And that's just the plain truth of it. They're stealing from you. So if you're talking about that type of relationship, that let's say it for what it is. If you're stealing from them by taking a 15-minute break, they're stealing from you by calling you up and bothering you when you're on vacation. Now, such interruptions to time off are managed by planning ahead, she said. Cigna grants increasing amounts of vacation with length of service. Yet nationwide, 13% of all companies don't offer vacation time, up from 5% in 1998. Business has to understand that they pick up a tab of $150 billion a year in job stress costs. We were at the mercy of people who would rather get a root canal than give us time off. And if you look at these big executives, and I've read this in other places before, and if you look at how these people work, they're used to working 80 hours a week, 60, 70 hours a week. Managers and stuff like that, and CEOs who have a direct involvement with the company are always working, but they're management. They're not regular working people. They're management. The company is their life. That's what they're there for. And, of course, with the new overtime laws, they'd be perfectly willing to force people who would really are not managers, but to classify them as managers so that they can put them on a salary and make them work 50 to 60 or more hours a week. And as I said in the last show, they're not going to do that all at once. They're going to do that a little bit at a time, kind of like, you know, the slow boiling. Rather than jumping a frog in a boiling pot where he'll jump out, just put it in there when it's nice and warm and slowly boil it, and then he'll get caught and eventually die, which is what we're going to wind up doing, employment speaking. Now, Carol Kamen, the nonprofit executive director for the Arizona Children's Action Alliance, understands both the need to check into the office and stay away. For 2 weeks, I didn't know what was going on, Kamen said of her recent trip to Eastern Europe. At first, that was difficult, and then it stopped mattering. And, of course, the Europeans get a lot of vacation. They get 5 to 6 weeks. My friend Tim in Japan, we interviewed him a few weeks ago. He gets, I think, 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks paid vacation a year. That's paid vacation, folks. And you get 4 to 6 weeks. You could take a week off every 3 months, you know, if you want to time it like that. and that'll give you some real resting time. You know, you can just take a day or two here and there as you need it. I mean, some people take a day off on Friday, and they'll take a day off on Monday, and they'll get a nice four-day weekend out of it. And that's nice to have that little rest every now and then. We used to do that in the Air Force. We take a day of leave on Friday, and since we didn't work on the weekends, unless it was some sort of drill or something, then you would basically have a four-day vacation, but you would only be taking 2 days leave. It's economizing on it. I worked for NBC for the Olympics. I was working 12-hour shifts, talking about long hours of long shifts. And that was for 46 straight days. I didn't have a day off, but it was only a temporary job. So you put up with it for that. But Kamen, who took a trip to Eastern Europe, like I said, like so many other professionals, has worked while vacationing. And she has been known to check voicemail continuously while you're on vacation. And she says the moment you do that, it gobbles you up. You know, and there is, I want to say, a work ethic. I don't know if that's the right word for it. There is a work ethic in this country where people feel like, you know, they owe something to the boss. But you know what? They take advantage of that so much, and the work ethic just works against you so often. And it's sad to see it happen, but it's true. There's got to be a time where you got to realize that there is life after work. Excuse me. Professional radio, ladies and gentlemen. God, I'm tired. The sleeping pills are taking effect, actually. But it's all really goes into that thing about being happy. Is anybody really happy working that hard? How many people are really happy busting their ass all the time, even when they're not supposed to be working? I make it a point not to work at break times, although I fail at that sometimes. I'll come back to my spot earlier and just sit there, and if there's something I need to move around, I'll do it. When I really, really shouldn't do that. I value my free time, and I think everybody else should value their free time. But in this country, there's so many people who feel like, you know, the work is everything, and that's the do-all and end-all, because it's what earns you money, and that's understandable, but there's got to come a point, sooner or later, where you say, enough is enough, and I need to take some time, and I need to just chill out and not do anything in particular. Or sometimes people relax by getting work done around the house. I know there were things that I have needed to get done around the house, and I wish I had a whole day to do it. I wish if I hadn't worked overtime this week, I would have had a little bit more time to get the computer set up. Now I pretty much have to wait until next weekend. I took a few minutes tonight because I was so anxious once I got it to set up this new mixer. But other than that, I would rather have just, you know, checked my email and stuff like that, and read my blogs and read my sites and watched a little bit of TV because I don't watch as much as I used to, and then just go to sleep and relax and start a new day. And we're going to start a new segment here in a couple of minutes because I'm fading out on this one, and I'll do another segment probably tomorrow night or maybe tomorrow afternoon or early today afternoon, I should say, since it's already Tuesday. Anyway, we'll be back. Sam, play us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Tucker Joe Radio Show.
We are back on the Cup of Joe radio show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Once again, the URL for the site is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and the email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. And again, I want to welcome all of my listeners from the White Rose Society, my good friend Ben Birch, who hosts my archives there, and also all of my listeners at rantradio.com. And also I want to remind you of my Audio Hell music show, Saturdays 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that is on AKA Radio. That's AKA radio.com. Actually, I've been kind of on and off with that show because of my wife's health problems. However, I do what I can. You know, you do what you can. Where was I? You know, there was some comments on the board and in response to some of the stuff that I wrote. But actually, I think it was a response to the last show from my old nemesis, Beachon, talking about the ownership society that George Bush is peddling. And peddling is the right word for it because it's kind of like that old miracle cure salesman running around. Oh, it'll solve all your cures. You know, and Beachon has talked about his idea of an ownership society in the sense of where everybody earns money from owning a piece of it. And while I can discuss the merits of that theory on the basis of its theory, it is just that, a theory. I mean, let's face it. It hasn't been put into any kind of practice yet. And until it is put into some kind of practice, then I don't recommend it. You know, I'm changing some of the things here on the fly. I think that was more like it, what I had last time. I'm having a little hiss problems. New mixer, you know, I just got to find the right adjustments for it, but we'll get it set up. Until it has been put into practice, there's no way of objectively commenting on it. Liberalism, the New Deal, you know, that has had a working era, and it worked very well, actually. It worked too well. Tip O'Neill, former Democratic Speaker of the House, said it just right. He said, we did too good a job. We made people rich enough to want to vote Republican. You know, and that's basically what happened. If you want an ownership society, the money's got to come from somewhere. That is, people have to be able to earn enough in some way, shape, or form in order to buy into this. And in this country today, you're certainly not going to get that money by working for a living. That's the flat truth, if you're in the type of job that I am. You know, I mean, yeah, there are still jobs where you can do that, but the types of jobs that were the meat and potatoes, the backbone of this country, they're going away. They're just not there anymore. And we've had inflation. We've had inflation of prices and certainly of rent, which is a big one. But food has gone up. Rent has gone up. Now the price of gas is going through the roof. I mean, it's at unimaginable levels now. I mean, if 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, you would have said that gas prices were going to be this high, you would have been laughed at. Although, I don't know, some people might have thought about it pretty strongly. But the point is, you know, you suddenly switch to this ownership society, and how many people are going to get left behind on that? Thousands, millions of people are going to be left behind on that. And that's not right. If you want an ownership society, vote liberal. The closest thing that we've had to that is during the years after the New Deal got really going. You know, we'd say from like 1940 to like 1975. Before all the right-wing stuff really started to get put in, before Reaganomics and before Bush economies. You know, it's really not that difficult a thing to imagine. Just make sure that the people who can afford more pay more, because that way the people who can't afford it don't have the burden placed on them. It's really not that difficult a proposition to understand. And what's important to realize is that the reason why liberalism has fallen is because they became so complacent, and the people on the right have never stopped fighting. They've just always kind of dug away, kind of like a baseball team that gets a really, really big lead and just kind of sits back, and another team slowly starts chipping away. Of course, this is a never-ending baseball game. This always will go on, and you're always going to have these kind of, you know, clashes between left and right, and the pendulum's going to swing back and forth. And the reason it's going to swing back towards liberalism or something along those lines eventually is because these cocksuckers are going to get too carried away, and they're going to go overboard, and people are finally just going to say enough. But if you want an ownership society that works, people have to have the ability to earn the kind of money it takes to be a real participant in it and not just a wage slave. And that's basically, you know, whatever kind of merits you're going to argue with an ownership society, I'm not buying into any of this Republican horseshit. I mean, that's just flat out. And you shouldn't either. Because even if such a society had its worthwhile merits, and again, I'm not going to say yes or no on that just because it hasn't been tried yet for real. Even if it has its merits, they're going to be taken away by the corporate scumbags that run this country already. Or just looking for just another way of ripping you off. And all this really is like a nice fresh paint job on some old ideas. There's nothing new and radical about what Mr. Bush is talking about. There's nothing new or radical about it. It's all old nonsense wrapped up in a different package. Just more, you know, oil, snake oil salesman. Snake oil stuff. That's really all it is. If you want to be in an ownership society, vote for a liberal. Because a liberal is going to make sure you get a paid a decent wage for your hard work. They're going to make sure that you're not going to get ripped off by a big corporation. They're going to make sure that you have a good, healthy place to work and that you put in 40 hours a week and still can earn enough to really pay the bills and pay the rent, you know, and all that stuff, and to keep the prices and wages at a level so that where they balance out. That's how you have an ownership society. Where do you think the bulk of the investments came in from this country during that period of time, from the 40s to the mid-70s? Yeah, granted, the very rich people still had their big investment firms, but the middle class, a lot of them invested. And, you know, not everybody should be investing in the stock market anyway. If you don't know what you're doing there, you should stay out of it. Because there's plenty of people who will rip you off, that's for sure. That's for sure. You know, the stock market is a good thing, and, you know, I've never really been involved with it because, quite frankly, I don't fucking understand it. And I make it a rule not to get involved with something too much if I don't understand it. I get involved doing this radio show and talking about politics, but talking about politics is one thing. Putting stuff into action is another. And I could never be a politician, but I can have discussions about political theory and about what I think works and what I think is not going to work. Certainly there are enough people on talk show radio who don't know what the hell they're talking about. That's for sure. I'm not the only one. But at least I try, you know, and I try to give a little perspective that you're not seeing. I mean, these radio talk show hosts, they're nice people, don't get me wrong, except for the right-wingers. You know, the Mike Malloys and the Laura Flanagans and Laura Flanders, excuse me, and, you know, Al Franken and Jeanine Garofalo, and they're all nice people. But, you know, they're used to making huge sums of money. Now, I don't know if it was truly the case for someone like Jeanine Garofalo. I don't know if she grew up in a middle or lower middle class or you know, family group like I did. But for the most part, these people are used to making large, large sums of money. And I'm not used to doing that. And most of the people I talk to aren't used to doing that. Most of the people who are listening. And there used to be a day and there used to be an age when people could work at a job like I'm working now, a simple job in a steel manufacturer. I wouldn't say it was highly skilled labor, but it is skilled labor to a certain extent, although anybody can really be taught to do it. You could still have a job like that by yourself or even raising a small family and earn a decent living. And like I keep saying, my dad in the mid-1960s, he earned, I think, like $6.50, $6.75 an hour. And on that one salary alone, he was able to support a family of five. Now, I make more than twice what he makes. Well, almost twice what he made, but I can't support myself and my wife, and that's not right. And my wife hopefully will get accepted for disability. If she is, then that's great, and that means we can be able to rest up a little bit and put some money into savings, which is what we should be doing. But we can't afford to because every time we get caught up a little bit, something happens, like the car breaks down, or you need to pay a bill that came up suddenly, or just things come up. Shit happens. You know what I'm talking about. This is shit you deal with every day. Never mind all this theory shit that the Republicans are throwing at you because they want you to buy into whatever scheme they're doing. And the Democrats do some of the same stuff, too. But for the most part, the Democrats have done a very good job running the country. It wasn't perfect. I'm not going to sit here and say that it was a perfect society because it wasn't. There was still racism. There was still inequality. There was still injustice. You're never really going to get rid of all of those things, I don't believe. I don't believe in a utopian society. But I believe in a better society. I believe in a more perfect union. And the only way you're really going to get that is if we all work together towards it. Not if a small bunch of people at the top are dictating terms to everybody else. Whether you're talking about a leftist cabal or you're talking about a corporate oligarchy. It's not going to happen. Anyway, let me take a quick break. We'll have a little music. Sam, play us out.
The Cup of Joe Radio Show will be right back.
something.
What is that?
Wait, they mean it.
What is that?
It's in your nose.
Yes.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's butt.
CD.
No, this is wrong. You're hoarding for the movie star. I know it's about the ratings. What's going on with this show? Yeah, the Terminator can take over the show, but John Kerry, a war veteran, has to follow a freaking dog puppet. What's going on in America? What is wrong with America?
And we are back on the Cup of Joe radio show. That was Robert Smigel as the Triumph of the Comedy Insult Dog, the Insult Comedy Dog. And I'm not particularly favorite of that, but I love that little bit from Jay Leno's show not long after Rush Schwarzenegger was on talking about running for governor. I think that was actually before he won governor, when he announced that he was running to begin with. Oh, man, that's funny. And it's true. What the hell is wrong with America where, you know, John Kerry, who's running for president, is a war veteran, takes second place? It's because Schwarzenegger is the biggest celebrity. And people are saying how surprised they were that Schwarzenegger got in. I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all because he's a big celebrity. And people look at that. That's an important thing. And people looked at Bill Clinton kind of the same way. They looked at him less as a politician sometimes as they did as like this big celebrity. And... you know, it was the same kind of deal with Kennedy, I guess, because, you know, he looked young and he was intelligent. And, you know, obviously the ladies were attracted to him. And, you know, we live in a TV celebrity era. I mean, you know, you look at Eisenhower, you look at Truman, you look at Roosevelt. Would any of these people be able to win an election today? Roosevelt certainly wouldn't be able to hide the fact that he was in a wheelchair like he did. Not that it really made any difference to running the presidency, but if people perceived him as being physically weak, then they probably would not have voted for him, which would have been a shame because Roosevelt was one of the all-time great presidents. Just a reminder, this is the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. And Smigel, by the way, the same guy who does the Triumph, also does a bunch of those little short, it was a little, I forget what they call it, TV Playhouse, TV Funhouse or something like that. And they had one, I actually have the video of it, that showed all who owned all the networks and all the different companies that own the networks and why you can't get decent news coverage because the companies that own the networks were refused to allow the news divisions to do anything about it. And, you know, it only appeared just like once. The video, fortunately, people videotaped it, and it's been going around, but it only appeared on the air actually once on the original show, and it's never been aired before, to my knowledge, anyway. But it is all over the internet, and you can look for it. TV Funhouse, I believe it's called. They had some really funny stuff there. Speaking of Schwarzenegger, and that's one of the reasons why I put that little clip there, he gave a speech the other night. I didn't see the speech. I haven't really been watching the Republican convention that much because, quite frankly, they're all a bunch of shitheads, and I have no desire to see them. Never mind the fact that I work in the evening. If there's something that somebody points out that I really need to see, I can see it on C-SPAN. I'm thinking about looking at Schwarzenegger's speech on C-SPAN just to see what it sounds like. Apparently, he called unemployed people or underemployed people girly men or something like that. I just want to see the speech to see what he has to say. I don't, you know, fucking Schwarzenegger. You know, it pisses me off because I like a lot of his movies and I just can't stand to watch him now. You know, it's like the police squad movies have O.J. Simpson and I just can't stand to see it. Not because I think he's guilty or innocent, but just because you get so tired of it having shoved down your throat. And with Schwarzenegger, it's worse because it's an ongoing thing. And I just can't stand to watch his movies now. Same thing with Mel Gibson. And I like a lot of Mel Gibson's movies. At least not his recent ones, really. I saw Braveheart, and I thought Braveheart was good. That was the last decent movie he made. I haven't seen The Passion yet. My wife wants to see it, but I have very little desire to see a film that basically involves Jesus getting the crap beat out of him for an hour and a half or 2 hours or however long the friggin' movie is. You know, And I bet you Republicans feel the same way about, you know, great Democratic actors, people who are liberals who are politically active, like Martin Sheen or Paul Newman or people like that. Of course, we have the better actors. Schwarzenegger's a good movie star, but he's not a good actor. You know, there's a difference between being a movie star and an actor. You know that, don't you? Schwarzenegger's a movie star. Paul Newman is an actor. Robert De Niro is an actor. You know. Schwarzenegger can say lines, and I'm sure he's very professional on the set, except for when he's groping women, as the stories go. But he's not an actor in the sense of really getting into a role. I mean, he's a good muscle guy, and, you know, he's played physical roles like Conan and, you know, action films. And like I said, he's made some very good films. you know, but all the great ones are on the left anyway. Groucho Marx was an avowed liberal. There was a story about how when Nixon was forced to resign in disgrace from the White House, he was actually moving into a house not far from Groucho, who was alive at the time. And Groucho, who was a strong liberal, in fact, Groucho lost a lot of money in the stock market crash. In fact, almost everything that they had worked, he and his brothers had worked so hard to earn. And he became a big liberal after that because it protected him from stuff like that. It was his hard-earned work from traveling on the roads and you know, uncomfortable places and long train rides and stuff like that. They worked their asses off, and they lost it all due to speculation in the market. But when Groucho was asked how he felt about Nixon moving in close to him in California, although in fact it was only a couple of houses down, I think, Groucho said, better here than the White House. And that's just typical of Groucho, the wonderful wit. One of the funniest men who ever lived, without a question. And he didn't bring his politics into his show very much. If you look at You Bet Your Life, he never even talked about that stuff, which is cool, which is the way it should be. That's why I get so pissed off at John Wayne, is because he put his politics into his movies. You know, intentionally. I mean, he made the Green Berets to show that how wonderful and courageous all our boys were in Vietnam, and it just was bullshit. It was just bullshit. They weren't these clean-cut kids. They were, you know, guys going around shooting women and children, for Christ's sake. Some of them were doing it because they were afraid, because the Viet Cong did use women and children as weapons against us. But even so, we committed a lot of massacres and crimes that we should not have, and we should have been better than. And the bulk of the war was fought, as in Iraq, by the working poor. And that's the real shame of it. You know, in Fahrenheit 9/11, you saw how Michael Moore was talking to Marine recruiters and how they were going to the poorer neighborhoods. They weren't going into the rich neighborhoods because they knew they didn't have a chance in hell of getting anybody to sign up. And why should they sign up? Their lives are, you know, going pretty good. But, you know, and, you know, I'm a veteran myself, and I talk about joining the military as a good way for someone growing up in a poor family to get the kind of skills and qualifications that they need to get better work. And I'm all for it. I tried to get my stepson into the Air Force, and he went to basic training, but for medical reasons, he didn't make it through. Not his fault, but it would have been a good career thing for him if he would have, you know, if he would have managed to get through it. I mean, when you have the physical type of thing that he had, that prevented him, and I don't want to say it because it's a little personal, but when you have that, you can't really be in the service. But the thing about it is, it would have been good. He was worried that he wasn't going to be able to play his video games or meet people who played video games or, you know, the anime and stuff like that. And I said, what, are you kidding me? That's, you know, a lot of people in the military are like that. Anyway, back to what I wanted to talk about, because I got off on a little rant there. But, you know, it does annoy me that we're so celebrity conscious in this country. As far as politics are concerned, you know, people bitch about Michael Moore, but you know what? If the news had been doing its job, there wouldn't be a need for Michael Moore. There wouldn't be a need for people to point this out. While the Republican convention has been going on, there has been a scandal brewing underneath the radar, and it's going to remain underneath the radar if the people in power have anything to do with it. According to Jim Loeb in an article from LouRockwell.com, and Lou Rockwell's kind of But this is a pretty decent article, and it was quoted by Juan Cole, and I'm going to go back to Juan Cole after I finish here. But there was a scandal over claims that a Pentagon official passed highly classified secrets to a Zionist lobby group. And it's, according to Mr. Loeb, this is a part of a much broader set of FBI and Pentagon investigations of close collaboration between prominent U.S. neoconservatives and Israel dating back some 30 years. Now, according to the article, the guy who's under investigation is Pentagon Iran expert Lawrence Franklin. And he is one of the biggest war hawks apparently trying to get us to go into Iran, which is what will happen if Bush is put in office. And if you think Iraq is a fucked up situation, if you think Afghanistan is a fucked up situation, you ain't seen nothing like Iran. Because if we go in there, it's going to be a real hell to pay because they have five times the population of Iraq. And none of them like us, really. You know, they said that the Iraqis would be welcoming us with flowers. You know, and the guy that said that, they just had an assassination attempt of. Isn't that wonderful? Instead, all we did in Iraq is we replaced one strong-armed dictator with another, Alawi. You know, in the movie Sleeper, when Woody Allen and Diane Keaton went to, destroy the leader, stealing his nose. You have to see the movie. It's really funny. But they did it at the leadership of this guy named Erno, who wanted to lead a communist revolution in the future. And Woody Allen was like, "Don't you see? In a few weeks, we'll be stealing Erno's nose. You know, political situations don't work." And Diane Keaton asked him, he said, "If you don't believe in religion, you don't believe in politics. You know, what do you believe in?" And he said, "Sex and death, two things that occur once in life." At any rate, you know, we put Hussein in power back in the 80s, and back in the 70s, we helped him out too. And it's the same group of people: Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Faith and all these people, and this guy here, Lawrence Franklin, all the same group of people. And now, you know, we basically installed Alawi, and he's just as bad. And Chalabi, the guy, like I mentioned, Chalabi, who was the guy that we based a lot of our lies around, because, you know, he was just saying what we wanted to hear, there was an assassination attempt on him recently. So they're trying to get rid of him. They're trying desperately to get rid of him. You know, and he's going to become the next enemy, the next Emmanuel Goldstein, whoever the name of the character was from 1984. It's just sickening the way things are going right now. And according to Juan Cole, according to Mr. Loeb, knowledgeable sources who asked not to be identified said that the FBI has been intensively reviewing a series of past counterintelligence probes that were started against several high-profile neoconservatives, but never followed up with prosecutions, to the great frustration of counterintelligence officers in some cases. Some of these past investigations include top current officials such as Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Faith, whose office appears to be the focus of the most recently disclosed inquiry, and Richard Perle, who resigned as Defense Policy Board Chairman last year. Now, all three were subject of a lengthy investigative story by Stephen Green, published by Counterpunch in February. Green is the author of two books on United States-Israeli relations, including Taking Sides, America's Secret Relations with a Militant Israel, which relies heavily on interviews with former Pentagon and counterintelligence officials. Now, back to Juan Cole. Meanwhile, the Jerusalem Post reports that the FBI raided the offices of Stephen Rosen, the director of foreign policy issues for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, that's AIPAC, which is an enormously influential lobby. Now, earlier rumors swirled of an FBI investigation of how the Pentagon Office of Special Plans, set up by Douglas Faith, skewed intelligence on Iraq and may have illegally engaged in intelligence gathering. In fact, the investigation was being conducted by the Senate Intelligence and House Judiciary Committee staffs, not by the FBI. They're also looking into the possibility that Pentagon employees pursued unauthorized contracts aimed at preparing the way for overthrowing the governments of Iran and Syria. According to the Boston Globe, Senate Intelligence and House Judiciary staff members say inquiries into the Near East and South Asia Affairs Division have found preliminary evidence that some officials gathered questionable information on weapons of mass destruction from Iraqi exiles such as Chalabi without proper authorization, which helped build Mr. Bush's case for an invasion last year. The investigators are also looking into a more serious concern: whether the office engaged in illegal activity by holding unauthorized meetings with foreign nationals to destabilize Syria and Iran without the presidential approval required for covert operations. Back to Juan Cole. A pattern of illegal payments for such information is also at issue. Laura Rosen says she has evidence that Pentagon officials paid Manushir Gurbanifar, and I'm sure I mangled that. I apologize for that, for documents he provided. By the way, Mr. Cole personally doesn't expect any dramatic developments from all of these investigations, and neither do I. AIPAC has powerful protectors on Capitol Hill, and past charges that it was involved in espionage for Israel have always been buried. As for the neoconservative cult in the Pentagon, even if they did something illegal, the odds are they wouldn't suffer much because of it. If you look at where the Iran-Contra criminals are, the ones who subverted the U.S. Constitution, stole weapons from the Pentagon to sell illegally to Ayatollah Khomeini, they're all working in the government. One Iran-Contra figure who lied to Congress now serves in the National Security Council as the person in charge of the Israeli-Palestine issue. That's Elliot Abrams, who was pardoned by Bush the Elder and who now sets White House policy on among the more important issues affecting U.S. relations with the Muslim world. This is Abrams. He was a convicted criminal who was pardoned. Bush may as well have just appointed Ariel Sharon to advise him on how to deal with Ariel Sharon. Though, to be fair, Sharon is probably more pragmatic than that and to the left of Abrams. Now, moreover, if Sharon and AIPAC decide that they need the U.S. government to take military action against Iran, it is likely that the U.S. government will do so. They can mobilize the U.S. evangelicals in favor of this step, putting enormous pressure on Congress and on the president. Many Iranian expatriates are extremely wealthy and well-connected, and they want such military action. And firms like Halliburton, which find workarounds allowing them to make money in Iran, and did so, by the way, when Dick Cheney was a CEO, would love to get rid of the mullahs so they can make the big bucks and more straightforwardly. So it isn't that AIPAC can snap its fingers and make something happen in Washington, but it can put together powerful coalitions and leverage its influence through policy allies, which does not tend to make things happen. Which does tend to make things happen, excuse me. I didn't think that was right. Mr. Cole and I personally don't believe that the Iraqi war has been good for Israel in reality, since there is now a great deal of instability on Israel's front porch. And the Falouhans have already declared solidarity with Hamas. Wonderful. I don't think U.S. military action against Iran would be good for anyone, since it would further destabilize the Persian Gulf. By the way, the high oil prices can't be good for the Israeli economy either. But American politics has become so dominated by single-issue lobbies that they far outweigh the concerns of a mere voter, or a couple of mere voters, or a million or so people marching in the streets. By the way, when they had the protest on Sunday for the Republican convention, the New York Times said there were tens of thousands, which means there were probably around 500,000, maybe 250,000, between 250 and 500,000, maybe even more than that. And in the meantime, of course, things in Iraq are continuing. There's just nothing much you can do about that, you know. And from all reports, we've basically lost control of the left-hand side of the western end of Iraq. And, of course, there was another bombing in Afghanistan. We don't have control of these countries, people. Don't have control of these countries. We sit there in our armed fortifications and we'll go out into some of the areas, but for the most part, we really don't control the country. And again, Alawi is just another strong-arm dictator. Is all he is. It's another Hussein. And we'll be going after him, I'm sure, in time. Now, if we allowed the Iraqis to make their own choice, they'd probably choose someone like, Shiite religious leader Sistani, who would have the most credibility with the Iraqi people. But the Sunnis would object to that. And again, let me point out the history of Iraq. For those of you who aren't aware of it, Iraq was originally part of the old Ottoman Empire, what we know as Iraq today. And when the British took over that part of the world, how and why is too detailed to explain now. They basically took those areas and made them into one country. They created Iraq. and they basically put in place their own people there. And what they did was they sided with one of the groups. Really, Iraq should be three countries. There are three distinct groups of people that live there. There are the Kurds, who live mainly in the north. There are the Sunnis, who live mainly in the center eastern area, which is around the Baghdad area, I believe. And the Shiites, who are the majority, the overwhelming majority. And the British sided with the Shiites, I believe, and the Sunnis and the Kurds rose up. And, in fact, what's happening in Iraq now is fairly close to what happened with the British. The first year or so was relatively peaceful. There were some skirmishes, but relatively peaceful. But after that is when all hell broke loose. And that's basically what's going on now. And, in fact, it's been getting progressively worse and worse. And we actually lost more people this month in August of this in 2003, in 2004, than we lost in August of 2002. In 2003, God, I can't get my years straight. Wake up, Joe. So you know things are not getting better, and no matter how much polish you put on it, you're not going to make things better. And that's the damn truth of it all. That is the damn truth of it all. And I really just don't know what to do about it. I really just don't. I mean, I do this radio show. That was when I went to that meeting, the Democratic fundraiser thing. That was the crux of it. Where I said, look, you know, I'd like to get out and do the more of the actual hardcore campaigning, but it's very difficult when you have an evening job and when you can't get around so easy. I can get around better now than I could during the Dean campaign because I have a vehicle. But it's hard for me to make these evening meetings when I'm working 3 to 11. I'm not going to take time off of work for that. I can't afford to do that. If I was independently wealthy or if I had a daytime job, it would be a different story. I'd like to go to more of these meetings and spread the word around. In fact, I need to make up business cards for the Cup of Joe show so I can start passing them out to people. It's a difficult situation. And as one blogger put it, the worry is whether or not we've done enough if Bush winds up in the White House again. And I believe that that's what's going to happen. Not that I think that Kerry is running a bad campaign. Because I don't think so. I think he's doing a very good job, despite what Bartkop and some of the other bloggers are saying. I think he's doing a very good job, and I think he understands how to win this. He's always been a strong finisher, and I think it's still a little too early to make any kind of predictions on what's going to happen. And obviously, Mr. Bush is going to get a little bounce from the convention. And of course, the Republicans are putting on their moderate face. But Iraq is still an ongoing situation. And just because the mainstream media isn't really following it that much, you can bet that people know what's going on there. Relatives of families know to a certain extent what's happening, and relatives of people who are serving. That is, it's just maddening that you try to do something. And what we don't understand on the left is that these type of movements take a long time. They take a long time to put together. It takes 20 to 30 years to really get something rolling. You can't do it overnight. You have to take your short-term losses like the conservatives did. It's not, it's not an impossible situation, and it may come down to some really nasty shit in the long run, but it's something that can be done. I mean, it didn't come easily. It didn't come easily, and it's not going to come easily this time around, because the price of complacency is way too high. Way too high. And this is the best action I can take at present. Maybe in the future things might change. If something happens, then if I can do more, I'll do more. But in the meantime, I'll do this show, which is as little as I can do. My friend AB, who helped me out with this nice computer and has helped me get the rest of my software back. In fact, I've pretty much got everything now, except for a front page, which is the big one that I want. I was saying if there's anything I can do for him, in return. I mean, I know he and his mother in particular, who he wrote me about, who enjoys the show. He says that he enjoys the show and that's good enough for him. And I'm like, yeah, but I feel a little guilty, that you're doing all this stuff for me and I really haven't been doing anything in return. But he's happy that the show is being done and. If there's something else I can do for him, I told him, I said, just let me know. If there's anything that's within my capabilities of doing, I'll do it. And I want to reciprocate like that. I wish there was a kind of Democratic machine like the Republican machine has. Because if I was a right-winger doing the same type of deal, I'm sure that they would have put me on a payroll somehow, somewhere. What's important to them is the message. The money they don't look at as losing money. They look at it as an investment. And I think Democrats need to do the same thing. And you have to look at Iraq. My brother sent me an email the other day because when he lost some power during Florida. And, you know, and he said, I felt really bad about, you know, having to live without power and stuff. But I thought of the soldiers in Iraq and what they were dealing with. And I didn't, you know, I said, you know, it could be worse. And I said, yeah, but at least no one lied to you about the storm, you know, about whether or not there was going to be a storm coming. I mean, these poor soldiers are working class people, just like most of us listening to the show. They're going to bear the brunt, and they're bearing the brunt of Mr. Bush's policies and all the neoconservatives in Washington. They're the ones who are paying the price for these decisions. They're the ones who are suffering for it. The neoconservatives, no matter what they do illegally, they're not going to suffer for it. The foundation of any society is trust. And when people lose trust in their government and their other professional institutions, then all hell breaks loose. Because if the laws are different for everybody, if you can't trust the people in power are going to enforce it against everybody, enforce the laws against everybody, then you can't believe that it's going to be a really free and equal society. And it's just like this ownership society bullshit. It's just bullshit. It's more snake oil. The ownership society means they own it, not you. Because you're not going to see a penny from it, I guarantee you. Certainly if you're a working person, if you got to go out and physically work for a living, unless you're doing some really high-paying consulting-type work or work in a specific field, you're not going to be able to earn enough money to be a real part of that ownership society. On the Laura Flanders show, when they talked about Kerry wanting to raise the minimum wage to $7 over 4 years or so, and I said, hell, they ought to raise it to $15 an hour. They ought to raise it immediately. I mean, $15 an hour is not even a living wage in a lot of cases, but it's enough to get by. It's enough to make your rent and pay your bills and stuff like that, barely, if you're living by yourself and you don't have a family to support, unless you want to live on ramen noodles. I hardly live in a lap of luxury. In fact, one of the things I discovered how to do was to make the yakisoba, which is pan-fried noodles that I love so much in Japan. It's not real yakisoba, but it's a decent equivalent, and it's just using 2 packs of ramen noodles and some Worcester sauce. And that's really about it. Some oil. A very inexpensive meal, but I enjoy it a great deal. I mean, I can take 2 packages and I make one meal from that, and that costs, you know, we're talking about maybe 50 cents for something like that. And I can eat at least one of those a day. It doesn't bother me because I enjoy it so much. But I like to eat nice every now and then, and I waste too much money eating out sometimes. And that's really my big vice. Some people smoke, some people drink, and they waste a lot of money on that. I'll go and I'll spend $20 to get some Chinese food from, you know, because I don't feel like cooking. Since my wife is sick, she can't really do the cooking or the cleaning as much anymore, so that burden is falling more on me, and I'm doing the best I can with it. I'm tired, and I'm stressed out, and I'm sure most of you are too. And being tired and stressed out, I am going to do pretty much the only thing I can do, and that's sign off. It's been an interesting show. It's been an interesting few weeks, and I apologize. The shows haven't been quite as good as they usually are. I haven't been able to get off on any really angry rants, but hey, you know, that's what you get. Anyway, until next time, this is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show, reminding you the website is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and the email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. So until next show, take care. Bye. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe Radio Show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.